I'm Michelle, and I am an alcoholic. Wow. I have to say, I wasn't nervous until about 30 seconds ago. When I usually qualify at meetings, I always open with, it's a privilege and an honor to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And tonight, by far, this is the biggest privilege and honor to speak at the Bill W. Dinner. Thank you to the committee for having me here. I have hope. That was the reading this morning in the 24-hour book. And when I got to AA, I did not have any hope. And today I can say I have hope. My sobriety dates February 1st, 2002. My home group is the Peekskill Group in Westchester. My sponsor's name is Barbara. And I first just want to thank my first home group, Trinity. Yay, Trinity. I know they're over there on 87th between 1st and 2nd. My second home group, which was the City 7:30 a.m. group, and I know I've got some folks there and there. I'd like to thank all three of my sponsors, Christy, Kathleen, and Barbara, and my sponsees, a few of who are here tonight. My experience, strength, and hope, what happened, what it was like, and how I got here. You know, I heard a lot when I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, people were uncomfortable and when they were 3, 4, 5 years old. And that's not my story. I had a pretty happy childhood. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic household. I had two parents who just drank socially once in a while. So everything was pretty good in my home. I was a happy kid. I got class clown in grammar school, class clown in high school, most talkative. So I'll try to keep this short tonight. But, you know, so pretty much I was okay. And I did well. I was a pretty accomplished young woman, and things really were pretty much going my way. And I also don't remember, even upon taking a first drink, probably around 16, 17, I was a little bit of a late bloomer with drinking, that, you know, it went down and I got this feeling. But I do remember when I drank anything of quantity, I got sick, and that was a theme to when I stopped drinking. I was a thrower-upper regularly. And when I went off to college, you know, my story of my college years was I drank really hard and a lot, but I also did well. And that's a real theme for all the years of drinking for me, was my ability to control, to accomplish, so it justified why I could drink as much as I was drinking. And, you know, in college, and I only say this because I always have to remind myself how much I drank, I would start the night off with a 100-proof bottle of peppermint schnapps. I would drink that down in about 45 minutes to get me ready. And then, I drank a case of beer. I would drink at least a case of beer. And that was a typical night out for me. And I really didn't see anything wrong with that because I was doing well in school. I thought that was perfectly okay. I had my dorm room set up with the waste paper basket, with aspirin. I knew I was going to have 360s. I knew I'd get sick, but that was perfectly okay. And I didn't really have consequences. You know, I hung out with a good group of people in college. They drank a lot, but we didn't get into trouble. So I was fortunate on that level. My first real consequence was my first year in grad school. I almost failed out because of my drinking, although I would never say that that's what happened. And I was able to pull myself up by my bootstraps my second year. I begged to stay in school, and I did well. And I controlled my drinking, and I really drank on the weekends so that I could get through my studies during the week. And that became the cycle for me. So when I moved to New York City or down to this area, I lived outside the city but worked in the city. My story was work really hard, work late at night, then go out, drink as much as I wanted to, as long as I could show up early the next day. When I got married, I was in my late 20s, surprised me. I did not expect to be married until at least into my 30s. You know, I always like to say this, is, you know, my husband at the time walked down the aisle with a really pretty bride, really looked good. About 2 years later, it was like Linda Blair, pea soup coming out of the mouth, my head was spinning around, and I got to tell you, this guy did not know what hit him. I mean, it was disastrous because alcohol was starting to progress for me, and even more so, you know, my outside illness of depression was taking over for me. And in 1994 was my first suicide attempt that landed me in a hospital, and in that year I had two very serious suicide attempts, which is a big part of my story and what landed me at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was nowhere near done drinking, and I did not even want to look at drinking as any part of what might be my problem. So the marriage ended, big surprise. But you know what I have to say about that is I became a liar, I became a cheater. I did things that I never ever thought that I was going to do. My standards started to go down to levels that I couldn't almost look at myself in the mirror, but I started to lie to myself in order to make it okay. I started to rationalize and justify, and it was all his fault or your fault or my parents because they were too strict when I was young, and then it was this one's fault. It was everybody else but me. I absolutely could not acknowledge that anything that was going wrong in my life possibly had it to do with me or my drinking. I moved out to California for a little while, and when I lived out there, if anybody knows Southern California, it's a really pretty place, I'd say. I saw the beach twice in 2.5 years. I lived 15 minutes from the coast because alcoholism had me in its grips. I didn't know it at the time because I knew nothing about our disease. I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, but it started to have me in the grips. I couldn't get out of the house. I had a house that looked out to a pool, and I would sit in my nice L.L. Bean plaid robe, and I would look longingly at that pool because it was sunny 360 out of 365 days out there. It drove me crazy, but I couldn't get out because I didn't drink around the clock necessarily, but that is the irritability, that's the fear setting in, that's the anxiety. And for this alcoholic, I became so fearful of interacting with people. And what I didn't know until I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I couldn't really interact well with people unless I had a drink in me. And I didn't understand that. In fact, I controlled my drinking so much that it probably took me up until the last few years to understand I probably would have been better off drinking a lot more than I drank, because it might have eased up some of the anxiety, but I controlled it so much I wouldn't let myself drink as much as I probably needed to as an alcoholic. When I came back to New York, the story goes really fast. You know, I was the, I have to add, I did have some drunk driving accidents in there too. I don't want to miss that because fortunately, I didn't hurt anyone else. I hurt myself. I totaled a car because I almost hit a deer. There was no deer, but I held to that story for a really long time. That was my story. There was a deer. There was a deer. No, there was an embankment and there was a ditch. There was a blackout and that's where I went. That's what happened. Took a little while for me to get there. It's called the fourth step. Took me a little while to dig through all of that. I was not a blackout drinker, but I was a grayout drinker, but I did have a couple of real, I did have blackouts that I learned about in AA, and I got to tell me that they terrified me. They absolutely terrified me. And with the discomfort of my other illness, the depression and the suicide, I mean, I was a mess. I was getting blacker and blacker on the inside. My outsides, it's hard always for me to say, how did I look? Did I look good? Did I not look good? I pretty much was able to suit up and show up well. I always like to say that, you know, I threw up in a toilet. I threw up in a waste paper basket. I took out my contacts at 5 a.m. I washed my face. How could I possibly have a problem with drinking? That was how I defined it. You know, it was this intense control over everything. It was, well, I won't run the dishwasher until the wine glasses are out of the closet. There's not enough of them. So now I'll run the dishwasher. But I had all three parts of our disease, the mental obsession, the physical compulsion, and the spiritual bankruptcy. You know, my mental obsession was, if the waiter came around and poured wine and I was out to dinner with girlfriends and my glass had a half inch less than someone else's, I was furious. Why does her glass have more than my glass? And I don't know why her glass, but I think my glass should have more. And this was the conversation in my head. And then the worst was if the bottle was put in whatever that thing is that they put the bottles in by the table, and the second bottle wasn't ordered. Because I'm sitting there at this table going, but I'm going to need more wine. But all of this is going on in my head by myself. I'm not saying anything to anybody. I'm doing this to myself. I didn't know that was the mental obsession of this disease, and that's what I had. I was completely overtaken with it. And the physical compulsion was when I moved back to New York and I lived on the Upper East Side, I would go out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with an intention of 2 glasses of wine. I was a wino, as you could tell. And I'd come home at 4 in the morning and I couldn't figure out how that happened. Couldn't figure it out. I'm like, no, but I only really wanted to go out for 2. How did I get home at 4 in the morning? That was the physical compulsion, because once I put a few glasses in me, all bets were off. I had to have more. And that's where it landed me. And spiritually, I always had a belief in a higher power, but I felt that God had absolutely forsaken me. How could a God want me to kill myself all the time? And how could he have left me feeling so lonely, so anxiously apart from the world? And that's exactly how I felt. And I was the woman who sat at the end of the bar by herself, having the drink, thinking, though, that I was going to meet the man of my dreams, although I never picked my head up and I never smiled. But that was my story. And that's what happened to me. What happened quickly at the end was I went on a wild love affair in 2001 to Australia. I'm here. Nothing happened over there. But when I came back from that, I remember looking in the mirror and the capillaries were breaking in my face. And I had a resignation in myself that I said, you know what? This is just the way it's going to be. I can't stop drinking. And it was that final self-admission within myself that there was nothing I could do about it, because I didn't know this was a solution. 2 weeks later, went out with a girlfriend, begged her to go out drinking with me. I drank by myself a lot, but I also liked to go out with somebody, so I begged her. She went out with me, came home before midnight. Guy in Australia didn't want to take my calls, and I thought it would be a perfectly good idea to shove 300 pills down my throat, and that's what I did. I survived. I landed in Metropolitan Hospital, and I had no intention of stopping drinking. No one could have told me that was my last night of drinking. But as I remember it, that week in the hospital, I was arrogant, I was full of ego. And I got to tell you, my somewhat impressive resume doesn't get you far in a psych ward. That's the truth. So as the judge told me to sit my butt back down in the psych ward, as I argued to get out of the psych ward, I slept with a blanket for my pillow, plastic mattress, being supervised if you wanted to shave your legs. It was a tough week, and this is how I remember it. I might have a foggy memory at this point, but as I remember it, my last day, as I was packing up to leave, the nurse on the ward said to me, Michelle, you might want to think about not drinking. And I haven't had a reason to pick up a drink since. When I got here, I want to give credit to the medical community, because my psychiatrist that past year had given me the number of intergroup, which I promptly put aside, didn't call it, but she did say what AA would do for me. What she said to me was, A is not only going to help you with your drinking, but it's going to rewire your brain in terms of how you think. And you need to think in terms of one day at a time and stay in the day. And that will help you with your suicidal thinking also. And for me, that absolutely is what kept my butt in the seat. My psychologist helped get me to my first meeting, and I want to give credit to Saul Lambert, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who has since passed away, and he took me to my first meeting down in Irving Place. And I didn't go to a lot of meetings, so if anybody's here that's new, coming back, hasn't been around a while, don't follow what I did, because I made it hard on myself. I went to very few meetings. I sat in the back. I didn't come early. I left early. I came late. But I was so in such pain. And my home group that became Trinity would took bets on me that I wasn't going to make it, although I did. I just couldn't interact with you. I was okay with you all over there and me here because the pain was too great for me. I was dying inside. But I remember at 50 days sober, I sat on my doctor's couch and I had seen in one of the rooms something about the primary purpose. And I got to tell you, that kept me alive for a year. I was like, maybe that's why I have to be alive. Like, I've got to stay alive to help another alcoholic. And for whatever reason, that gave me hope. And I opened tonight with I have hope, because when I came into the rooms, what I saw around me in meetings were people like tonight who just had hope on their face, who looked better than I did. And even though I couldn't talk to any of you, you looked at me and you smiled and you made it okay for me. You made it okay for me to come back over and over. And a few funny things. My first sponsor, how I got her, because one of the meetings, people raised hands to say they would be sponsors. I liked her boots. Worked for me. You know, I ordered my first big book off of Amazon.com because I couldn't talk to any of you, even though they're readily available at meetings. And then one of my funnier stories is when I went to a holiday party that first year, which I still can't believe I actually went to, someone came up to me and said, oh, are you a friend of Bill's? And I said, no, I'm here with Sandy. Didn't quite get the lingo. I'm up to snuff now, though. It took me a while. But, you know, I used to think my friends who are not like me, who are really pretty wonderful people, that they always got some book in high school that I must have missed, and or some class that I missed about the book of life. You know, I'm fairly good in my business world and so forth, but I tell you, living day-to-day life, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. It was perplexing to me. And once I got the big book and I got my hands on that and I read it and I started paying attention in meetings, I said to my friends, I'm catching up with you guys. I'm catching up. I'm now getting the understanding of what it means to live a day at a time and to live life normally. You know, and my sobriety since then has been filled with life. It's been both my parents have passed away in sobriety. I've had jobs. I've gotten fired from a job. I've started a business. I've lost a business. And I've also had a really terrible bout with depression and suicide in sobriety. And what I just want to say about that is that's why there's outside help. As much as you can be in the steps, you can be in the big book, and you can be in meetings, it's suggested that we get outside help for outside illnesses. And that's what I need. AA is my cornerstone. It's a death sentence if I pick up a drink. So I know that that's what I need to do for me. And what I just would like to end with, because I'm really looking forward to our other speakers, Diane and Calvin, is when I came to my first Bill W. in 2002, I was terrified. I mean, absolutely terrified. I looked around at this room, and I think I didn't move in my seat. I sat glued in the seat and just looked forward. But I remember the gentleman, one of the speakers, said something about having their membership card for Alcoholics Anonymous and that he wasn't planning to give it up. And I said to myself, gosh, I hope that's me. I hope I have a membership card. I don't know if they give them out, but if they do, I'll find it. Again, I wasn't picking up on the lingo too quickly. But, you know, here it is now in 2014, and I've managed to keep my membership card a day at a time. And when I think now about where I am, I've gotten remarried in sobriety. My lovely husband is here tonight and so supportive of my sobriety, and I'm so grateful for that. And I know that some people come to the Bill W. and it's their first time, or they've come many times, but I've also heard that some people have come to the Bill W. dinner and they've left here and they've gone out and they've had a drink, because we're alcoholic and that's what we do. So I just would like to ask all of you tonight to please make sure you turn to your left, turn to your right, say hello to the people at the table. Know that even though we may look really good tonight and dressed up, some of us are in pain. I was in a lot of pain for a long time in meetings, and even though I might have looked okay, I wasn't okay. So make sure you put your hand out to the alcoholic. Our triangle says responsibility, unity, and service. And when I did service for the big meeting for the hospitality, I want to give a shout out to the Bronx, because they really helped me with doing a lot of service. And really got me out of myself and got me to learn about really helping others. Service has been my godsend for all the time that I've been in AA, so I feel so strongly about staying in service and helping another alcoholic. As I told you, that 50 days sober, I was told to look at my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic, and I still believe that today. I'm Michelle, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful to be here.
Thank you, Michelle. And now I would like to introduce our second speaker, Calvin B. from the Just Trying Group in Queens.
Wow. Good evening, everyone. My name is Calvin, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Calvin.
Hi, back. I'm grateful I no longer live on Calvin principles, but I practice the AA principle that saved my bacon. And I don't say that to try and impress you. I no longer live in the problem today. I live in the solution. And I thank God for all of us being sober today in his presence. This is the best thing going for drunks since the AA meeting. Can't get any better than this. You can't get this at home. I'm so grateful to be a member of a powerful program that works for drunks like us. And I thank the group, and I thank the intergroup, and I thank the committee, the whole committee. And I thank Tony for reading the lighting up the candles. I took a walk today, and I saw a drunk laying out in the street, and I thought about the gift that we have. You know, that God gave us this the gift, not to the brilliant, not to the genius, not to the clergyman. He gave it to the drunk, the lost cause, the weakling. And here we are today celebrating 79 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a program about living, not about dying. I want to thank Michelle, with a lot of identification, and thank you for being you, for showing up also. I couldn't do this without y'all. Y'all need to know I was a drunk. I didn't come in here sober. I need to put that out there. My sober day was 1985, September 26th, and I'm only sober by the grace of God. My sponsor line starts from great-grand sponsor Liz B., who have 62 years, and her sponsee Kent S. have 60 years to celebrate it. And then my sponsor 5672, Gene H., who just died just recently, about 4 years ago. And my sponsor today is Rodney P. And my best friend Diane, that's my rolling partner. Gave me the courage to stand up here before you, and I thank my wife, but I got to thank her now before I forget her. My heroes of drinking was Doc Holliday and the Thin Man, so you need to know I was a drunk. That's what I meant. You know, Doc Holliday was my hero, and I loved the way he drank. He was dapper, clean. If he gets sick and gurgitate, he goes back drinking. If you get him mad, he'll shoot you and come back drinking. I saw controlled drinking, you know. And then my second hero was Nick Charles, the Thin Man. God, I loved his wife. I looked for his wife for a long time, and I say, nobody ever interfered with Nick's drinking, you know. Cops asked Nick, can you solve a case? And he said, we'll talk it over some brandy. Then his lovely wife served him drinks 2:30 in the morning, you know, and I never see him once waste a drink. And I say, I want a drink just like that. Well, in my drinking career, no one ever asked me to solve a case. I've been kicked out of a lot of gambling places, and I never find Nick's wife. I never found her. So my second love was Lisbeth Montgomery, Samantha. And I know if she twinkled her little pretty nose, my whole life would be better, you know? It's only I had, every time I ran into a woman, anytime she twinkled her nose when she was putting something in it, I just had bad luck with ladies. I just had bad luck, you know, just bad luck, you know? I was the type of drunk that I didn't like drinking with amateur drunks, you know, the amateur drunks that have umbrellas and sticks and all that. That's sick drinking, you know. It should be a law. Nobody should be drinking like that, you know. Drink straight down, you know. And then I didn't like crying drunks, you know. I was very arrogant. I had this old car, if you put it in reverse, it go forward. And that was a chief activator in my car. Drunks would get in my car and they start crying and whining. I said, shut up, there's no crying in my car. Be a real man, go home and tell your wife you're the man of the house. You go and tell your supervisor you're coming when you feel like coming in. But I'm not telling them I got a call before I come home, you know. And I don't know if I'm going to have the key. I have to knock on the door. I don't know if I'm going to be sleeping in the kids' room or the bedroom. I'm always telling people what to do. And I tell them I have been where you have not been before. I told them I fought in Korea. I was on the lookout man on Pochop Hill, not born in 1951. Also been in the Bay of Pigs waiting for the Kennedy family to get this off. We go to Cuba, and I was sitting in the third grade. I also been in the civil rights movement in Montgomery, Alabama. I was always in the front line. When they sick the dog on us, I took my knife out. They say, "Wait a minute, this is a nonviolent, demonstration. Please put the knife away." You know, I was the type of drunk. I always had to out-top your story. I always had to out-top your story. That's how my drinking went along, you know. And I had built a wall of isolation that came with that drinking. That wall followed me everywhere I went. And I didn't like you. If you wasn't drinking, I didn't like you. I didn't trust you. And that wall just followed me everywhere I go. I built it so high, I couldn't go over it, so why I couldn't go around it. You know, when people say, how you doing? If you say hi to me, I was good with that. But once you say, how you doing, that means you're getting in my business. And that's too much conversation. That's too much conversation. You know? I was the type of drunk that I don't go to the liquor store at 8 o'clock in the morning like drunk girls. I go 5 after 9. 5 after 9 says I'm not a drunk like them, you know. And during that time, it was no bulletproof glass. It was just a plain, simple refrigerator. I don't go in there and say, Joe, how are you and the family? I couldn't care about Joe and his family. My business was about drinking. I put up two fingers. I mean, 250 gives me a nod. I go in the refrigerator, get the wine, and I leave out, and that was it. So one morning, 5 after 9, I walked in. Joe introduced me to the new proprietor of the store. And he let them know that my credit was good. So that morning, I walked in. This new proprietor said, Calvin, can I have a word with you in the back? I say, oh, my God, I hope he not ask me to work here. I don't want to work here. I just want to drink here, you know. He say, I noticed you've been doing this drinking a little bit, you know, early in the morning. You know, you should try to drink it, you know, in the evening or afternoon. I was pissed off. He's getting in my business. So if I wanted counseling, I'd get it from my wife. I don't need his counseling. So I took my business somewhere else. You know, and people love to tell you about your shortcoming. You know, do you know what you did last night? I didn't ask. But people like to go in. You know, they want to tell you this stuff, you know. And you know when they want to approach you about your drinking, they got this little protocol. They want to give you gum, you know. And they want to say, do you have a minute? And so when they start talking to me about my drinking, I curse them out so bad, I make them feel so bad that they will never talk to me again about my drinking. Because that was sacred grounds. You know, that was sacred grounds. No one would ever talk to me about my drinking. And it was hard for me, you know, when I was an active alcoholic, I drank alone. I felt comfortable being by myself. It wasn't all like drinking for the guys that's dead or upstate, all that kind of crazy mess, you know? It was a business about drinking. And my shakes had shakes. That's how bad I was drinking. You know, I couldn't tie my shoes in the morning, so I wear flip-flops and get out, you know, that's easy to get to, you know. One morning, 5 after 9, I went to the liquor store. I fell in love with this drink called 2020 Mad Dog's Shake in Lightning Creek. And the guy was emptying cases, put them on the shelf, and I said, wow, man, I said, a lot of people drinking that. He said, no, you're the only one drinking this stuff. It didn't tell me I had a problem. It told me he was getting in my business, you know? So I confronted somebody else. I confronted a friend. He said, yeah, Calvin, you're the only one drink this stuff, you know? So I cut him loose, you know? Cut him loose. I didn't like anybody know anything about my drinking. And I walked around here restless, irritable, and discontent. I had no idea. I didn't have a clue what was going on with me. I know today you could be drunk in here without the drink. I know you can die in here without the drink. Untreated alcoholism is no joke. And this is why we're living today. Lorraine mentioned how y'all look well and happy and everything, because we worked for this. You know, we worked for this. We have to always think about the drunk that who don't know there's a way out. Not for us to keep sharing the same old story among us. Let's think about the drunk that don't know there's a way out. Let's think about the drunk that's hopeless and helpless and looking for a way and don't know the way. This is why we have that moment of silence praying for the drunk that don't know. And that's why that lighting up the candles represent. We all could pray, you know, praise God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to sound like I'm some Hallmark greeting card, but this is the best thing going for drunks. So in my drinking career, you know, they had a funeral repast. I call them funeral reception, you know. I have this already made bow tie in my jacket. I don't care if they black and white. I'm going to go to the funeral, find out who died, read the obituary, go behind the funeral pile, find out where they're serving the drink and booze. That's drunk paradise. And I will go to the reception or the repast. And I would drink up their booze, and I would eat, and I'd pass out, and they wake me up, and they say, who you came here with, you know? And see, my neighborhood wasn't named like Melvin, John, and Calvin. My neighborhood was like named Bishop, Raheem, you know, Duke. And they say, we have nobody like that here. And they asked me to leave. You know, I heard them when the door slammed. It didn't say, Calvin, stop drinking. It said, watch your drinking. So, again, this happened several times, and I had a fetish for ladies. I had black stockings and pretty feet. I didn't know this was a widow, you know. I winked my eyes at her, did a little John Wayne walk over there to her, and I say, well, who's your man, you know? And then 5 minutes later, you know, they asked me to leave. And then when the door slammed, you know, it didn't say, Calvin, stop drinking. It said, watch your drinking, you know. And that's how I went, you know, my life. So around about 1984, and then drinking 3 days, just to speed the story up. I didn't drink for 3 days because I was broke. That's all. And then that early morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, my ex-wife asked me a tribute question. She said, Calma, do you remember the promise you made to me in 1973? And I'm looking at her, are you crazy? This is 1984. You want me to remember stuff like this? And so we start having these little Sugar Ray Hearns fight. And I told her what I was going to do to her as soon as I get off the floor. But right now I have to go to work. I have a big project that I need to address. So I tell her we'll take care of this when I get back. And I was telling her how much I don't need her. I could do bad by myself and all that kind of crap. And about 2 hours later, I'm in the emergency rooms. I'm having DTs, you know, the withdrawal from booze. And the doctor looked at me in the eyes. You know, I was like, he asked me personal questions again. I don't know why they do that. You know, how much you drink? I said, I drink one can of Budweiser a day, and that's it. That's all you need to know. But they know I was lying. Soon I opened my mouth, you know. So I say, look, doc, I have a little allergy. My, you know, tears coming out of my mouth. I could take care of this, you know. And he said, no, I can't let you go because you may go through convulsions. So I had to call the missus in order for me to leave. So I'm on the phone playing Barry White and Isaac Hayes. I said, honey, darling, dear, please come and get me out. And she reminded me what I told her. I said, forget about that. Just come down here and get me out. So when she got there to the emergency room, you know, I'm sitting on the gurney bed and then got into a football huddle talking about me, turned around, got back into the football huddle. And I say, oh, my God, I got to find a trap door. You know, I know they're talking about my drinking. And so they was using words I never heard before. They say detox sound like some laundry detergent. I don't know what's going on here, you know. I'm mad, like, you know, so if I'm a drunk, if I'm going down, everybody going down. I told her, your father drink, the nun drink, why everybody's picking on me, you know? And she said, shut up, Calvin, shut up. When they get you there to Freeport Hospital, they're going to suck you off with a big glass of whiskey. They're going to cut you down every day. I got quiet. I waited, you know. When they coming to pick me up, my wife bought me some new pajamas. It was blue on powder blue, you know, blue slippers. When I walked out the room, I saw people fishing with no pole on dry land, knitting with no needles, walking with IVs, and I'm looking for the line where they're serving the booze. So I went to the desk, and I knocked on the desk, madam, can you please tell me which line they're serving the booze? And she said, you had your last drink when you got here. So I was mad. I went to the phone, cursed the ex-wife out. You tricked me. You tricked me, you know. She said, Calvin, you could do this one day at a time. They come from AA, come from a way of living. I didn't want to hear that. I slammed the phone down, ran back to the desk, and demanded to be released. As you see, I'm not like these people here. And she said, if you leave, you get no check. So I reconsider and I stay. I had no idea you get paid saying you're an alcoholic. So you'll find my story in the big book on chapter 3. The reservation had to be smashed. I walked around here 9 months, dry drunk, untreated alcoholism. People go in the park and feed pigeons. I go in the park and chase the pigeons out. People ask me what time it is and say, buy a watch, you so-and-so, you know. People ask me for a dollar, get a job, you know. My ex-wife tried to get me to do active things what couples do. She'd say, well, Calvin, let's walk on the boardwalk. I said, are you kidding? I'm not drinking. And then she said, well, let's go to the movies. Oh, I'm not going to the movies without a drink. And she said, well, Calvin, Joe drink? I said, no, I don't drink with Joe. Every time you drink with Joe, he put the cap on the bottle. That is not drinking. And she was so fed up. She said, drink, you're so miserable, drink. And I said, no, not today, you know, arrogance. And I walked around here, untreated alcoholism. And I was so drunk without the drink. I'm only sober by the grace of God. When I came into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, y'all knew more about me than I knew about myself. When I first came in, because I always drank to the rim, I remember my first cup of coffee. I poured it all the way up to the rim. I had no room for the sugar, no stirrers. And I didn't want nobody to know I was new because I was shaking. And a guy came over there and he poured, he said, half a cup. I said, oh, my God, they're genius in here. Half a cup, you know. He set me down at my first table. It was a lady speaking. She was talking about her, but she was talking about me. And that's why I heard my story. But I was sitting here with 30 days, and I'm hearing one guy say he's holy dude. The other guy say he's cross-addicted. One say he's an addict. I said, oh, my God, I need a title myself. Everybody walking around here with a title. So I said, I had to go home and make up one. I said, my name is Calvin. I'm holy dude, cross-addicted, grateful, recovering alcoholic, and an addict with a compulsion to drink from Howard University of California. If you drink right-handed, you eventually drink left-handed. Everybody looked around and said, keep coming, you know. The man to be my sponsor asked me, can you please repeat what you said out there? I repeated. He said, I never heard any crap like that in AA all my life. He said, what we'll do, we do a 90-90. Within that five-minute coffee break, I knew he knew about the drinking game. That eye-to-eye, that knee-to-knee, he made me feel comfortable. He never talked down to me. He let me know there was hope. And I knew I was so glad he was a member of AA. I was so glad that he had God in his life. Because the story that he told me, I said, oh, God, I felt so sorry for him. But he had something that I wanted. He had that peace of mind. He had that peace of mind. So speed it up. In my first year anniversary, During my first year anniversary, they give you a lighter with the Serenity Prayer on your name, and you get a leader and two speakers. And so my wife was upset. She said, Calvin, when do I speak? I said, I haven't been here to see spouse speaks. And so she was angry that she couldn't speak. She wasn't coming. She just wants y'all to know, don't trust him. That's what she wanted to tell you, because she was angry for what y'all have done. Within 365 days a year, y'all had changed my life. So I stay here long enough, do service and everything. I had a well-informed group. My group existed in 1947, and they died within 1956. Because they were telling drunk stories, and they do service and volunteer, give back what was freely given to us. You know, I was a member of about four groups, and they fell within. But I just want to make it perfectly clear, I had nothing to do with that. Just in case, if I come and join your group, you'll probably say, no, don't let him in. He's a group man. I said, it's good to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to live by this program. You know, you're not just reading it, but you got to practice what you read. It's in the giving, the unity and service. It's in the giving. If you pick up more than one chair, you're doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous. So in my fifth year, I got restless, irritable, discontent, self-pity, sponsoring myself. And I loved my home group, but all of a sudden, everybody in my home group was getting on my nerve. God talking like he wrote the book with Bill and Bob. Another guy talking like he Hallmark greeting card, you know, want to sound like a poet all the time, you know. Guy drinking seven cups of coffee with milk and then put a dollar in it, you know. Everybody's just getting on my nerve. And then a newcomer walking around with her cleavage all open. I want to throw my shoes at her. I said, she walked by me one more time. And then they give me, you know, newcomer, they give you the meeting book to put your telephone number. I said, my phone don't work, you know. And I went home to commit suicide. It wasn't about picking up a drink. It was not picking up a drink. I was restless, irritable. My old friends came back. They're thinking. I got a 12-step call to pick up a wet drunk. I was pissed off at my group. Now, where the members at? I'm busy trying to commit suicide. I got to stop this and go and pick up this wet drunk. This is why I'm angry at them. They're supposed to be in the front lines. When I went and picked up that wet drunk, I looked in his eyes, I saw my life in his eyes. AA in the high power. And I had to tell him, I'm only sober by the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 6 and 7 is the only step that's in the present that saved my bacon today. Every morning I'm entirely ready to have God remove all defects of character, not holding on to nothing. So I had to learn how to give back what was freely given to me. I used to go to my sponsor and say, Joe, you know, I've been thinking. He said, oh, God, Calvin, not that again, you know. Please. We don't think here. We ponder, we look at, reflect, but no thinking. Anytime you hear drunk thinking, just move your chair to the side. Drunks love to think, you know, so just watch the thinking. Even today, after all these years, my wife right now presently don't trust my thinking. I would say, honey, I've been thinking. She'd say, oh, please, call your sponsor, Calvin. It's a program of giving. Giving, well, you know, you can't give anything that you, if you don't have it, you can't give what you don't have. We freely give. Always think about the drunk that who don't know this is a way out. We love the newcomers because we know what they can get if they stay here. We're showered down with all the information. You never know who's watching you, neighbors, friends. And here we are, we carrying the gift of life, the gift of living, not dying. If you want to die, you go home and die. But if you want to live, it's right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so emotional, grateful right now looking at you and knowing I could not do this without you. I'm so humbly, humbly grateful to be a member of a powerful program that works for drunks like us. And may God keep you in the palm of his hand each and every day that we wake up, because there's work here to be done. Don't be a thief in Alcoholics Anonymous. Give back what was freely given to us. And that's the message that's been passed on to me. There's moments that I go through things and, you know, life situation pops up, but I don't drink. I had a close friend who was dying, who had died, two breasts moved from, you know, had cancer, two of her breasts was moved. Every time I go and see her in the hospital, she say, "Calvin, don't let nobody get my job. I'm still the secretary." I said, "Okay, you got the job." And this is what always gives me the inspiration, that no matter what kind of illness or whatever go through our life, we don't drink. And that's the gift. That's the gift. Today, I have a friend, Stephanie, who's going through a life situation, cancer. And I always pray for her, and I ask you to pray for her today. Still another soldier going through life situation, but we don't drink. I don't know how much time I have. It's almost over. Then I thank you for allowing me to share. Thanks for keeping me sober.
We want to thank you again, Calvin. And with that, we're going to have our third speaker now, and that is Diane from the Dykeman Group in Manhattan.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Diane, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. And I'm so grateful to be here. You know, we are not a glum lot. Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Calvin. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the Shears, and we're funny people. our stories. I want to thank God for this opportunity. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. You know, people will ask me, "Are you nervous?" You know, but I got the support for all you people here. You know, so this is wonderful. And I thank Dr. Bob and Bill and Henrietta and Dr. Silkworth and a whole host of our pioneers, and Jack Alexander for writing such a wonderful article about us, you know, getting the word, really getting it out there, reaching alcoholics, you know, that were still suffering. This is, like Calvin said, a powerful program, and I love it. I absolutely love this program from the first day that I came in for myself. And I say for myself because I have an older brother who has more time than I, and he took me to meetings with him, and, you know, I didn't get it. I didn't like it. I didn't want to be there, and I was always looking at my watch to get out of there. But when I came for myself, it's like, wow, this program is really powerful. I started drinking at a very early age. I was a child drunk. My parents didn't drink. My father drank, but he would sit in the living room and listen to his jazz music, and he would have one drink and sit in that living room for hours listening to music. I saw my mother drink a couple of times, and she got sick and said, this is not for me. So their drinking wasn't attractive. You know, it wasn't appealing to me. And I know that my father had the one drink because I used to sit in the living room with him and listen to jazz. And he would always tell me, "Get me some more ice." And he would put ice after ice into this one drink. You know, so I went to my girlfriend's house once, and I must have been like 10, 11 years old. And her mother was in the living room with her friends, and they were drinking, and they were laughing, and they were having a great time. And I said, "Wow, you know, this looks fun the way they're doing it, you know." And I have to say that I was one of those children who felt one of those people not a part of. You know, I just didn't feel a part of anything. Like, I didn't belong, and I wanted to become invisible. I never wanted, you know, I didn't have suicide ideations, but I just didn't want you to see me, you know. And people told me I was a cute little girl, I had real long hair, and that drew a lot of attention to me, and I didn't want the attention. And I used to sit in a corner and try to will myself invisible, you know. I just didn't want to be seen. And when I saw this drinking going on and the fun that these women were having, I was in the kitchen, and I was probably going out. I mean, I was in a room with my friends playing with dolls, you know, age-appropriate toys. And I This my friend's mother took a, she poured a drink, and when she turned her back, I took the drink. And she turned around and she looked at me and I looked at her. And, you know, and it, by this time she was already intoxicated. So I guess she was like, you know, I noticed, you know, little girl didn't drink my drink. So she did it again and she turned around. I don't know why she was turning around. I guess when I got older, maybe she was trying to, going to get a chaser or something for the drink. And I drank it again. And, you know, at this tender age, the only thing I was used to drinking was like Kool-Aid or chocolate or strawberry milk. But I remember the strength of this drink. It was strong, it was powerful, it was hot. And it went down my throat to my stomach, and then it went back up, and I said, whew, I don't want to be invisible anymore. You know? And I went in the room. First, I stole a cigarette from her cigarette case, too. I used to smoke at an early age. And I went in the bathroom and smoked a cigarette. Then I went to room with my friends, and I told them, we have to drink. You know, I just stole your mother's drink, your mother's liquor. And, you know, I mean, these girls were like 10, 11 years old. I said, what do you mean? We can drink? You know, we're not supposed to drink. I was like, oh, what the feeling. And I started falling all over the room and, you know, laughing and was happy. And they were looking at me. And then that became attractive to them, you know. And they said, well, maybe, okay. You know, but now how are we going to get this money to drink? You know, how are we going to do this? So I was like the mastermind, you know, behind this drinking escapade. And so I told them that we'll go outside. We lived in Harlem. We'll go outside and we'll tell people that we live in the Bronx and that we lost our car fare and we need to get home. So I said, okay, we'll see if it works. So we did this. And people were giving us money. You know, they're little girls, like five of us. They felt sorry for us. And sure, you know, it was 25 cents then. And they were giving us money to get home. And then we got enough money. And we got a lot of money. And we went to the liquor store. And we were looking in the liquor store window as if it was a candy store. You know, like, what should we buy? What should we buy? And I saw something named 10 High. I still don't know what that is, this 10 High thing. But anyway, I told them that one, because it's five of us, and it'll get us doubly high. So, doubly drunk. So we asked the wino, what we used to call at that time winos. We asked the wino to buy us that 10 high, and we'll give you 20 cents, whatever, to buy your, you know, your cheap drink. So this is what we did. He bought us the 10 high, and we gave him the money to buy his wine, and we went upstairs on the roof, and we drank. We got drunk. So this was our weekend thing. We called it bumming. You know, it's let's go bumming this weekend. And you know, and that it got me out of myself. You know, I didn't feel comfortable in my home before that. I used to tell my mother, you know how you have older siblings and they say that, and they tell you things like, you know, you were adopted. We found you on a doorstep or in a garbage can. But actually, I was the one saying it. I used to tell my mother, I was adopted. You know, I don't belong here. I don't belong in this family. And there was a lady who lived across from us, and she exhibited, like, extreme bizarre behavior. And she would moon people and scream out her window and throw stuff. So my mother got tired of me saying it, and she said, I'm not your mother? Okay, that's your mother over there. She said, go live with her. You act like her anyway. So I never said it again, but I still felt it. You know, but I loved drinking. You know, it took me out of myself. It made me feel comfortable. I said, this is something I'm going to do for the rest of my life. How could I live without it? You know, it's impossible for me to live without drinking. So I drank. I drank from that age until I was 33, until I came into the program. And when I first started drinking, it was just fun, you know. And then, of course, near the end, you know, it became a chore. But I didn't want to go to school. I refused to go to school. And I sat my parents down when I was probably in a sixth grade or seventh grade, and I told my mother and father, I'm not going to school anymore. And he said, what? You know, and I said, no. I said, it's a waste of time, you know. Why should I go to school when there's so much fun out here to be had? And, you know, I sat them down, you know, and I said, I need to speak to you about something. And they said, well, you have to go to school. And I said, I don't want to go to school, you know. And so I experienced my first rehab because my older brother took me to a rehab when I was around 14 years old because I was a little drunk, out of control. And, you know, just like a tornado roaring through my family, and they couldn't take it. You know, I begged them to not have him take me, but they didn't know what to do with me at this point. You know, they would punish me, threatened to send me away, and I just didn't care. And I also used to run away. You know, so my brother took me to this rehab, and I think I was there all of 2 hours after he left, because I raised so much cane in this place after he left that they actually threw me out. They, you know, there was I was a child, they threw me out. And then I called my then a friend of mine who was a dope addict and a drug dealer, and he came and picked me up from this rehab, and my family didn't see me for a couple of days, and they were a nervous wreck, you know. And then I went back home, and they just didn't know what to do with me. You know, I just became a really crazy drunk. I didn't want to drink out of the glass anymore because my alcoholic mind told me that if I poured the drink from the bottle into the glass, that it would lose its potency and I wouldn't get as drunk. And I said, wow, that's a, you know, really good idea. You know, that's a great concept. So I just actually started drinking from the bottle, you know, like bottle to lip. And I used to go out on dates, and the guys would ask me if I drank, and I would say, no, not really, you know, just like on special occasions or whatever. And I always had a pint of liquor in my pocketbook. And so I would order a glass of wine, and no matter how much I wanted to leave a little bit of wine in that glass to really prove that I don't drink, I couldn't do it, even though I had a pint in my pocketbook. And I would go in the bathroom, and I would, you know, drink from the pint, and then I'd come back out and take a sip of the wine, and then go back to the bathroom and drink from my pint of liquor and go back out. And they would say to me, you know, boy, you're right. You really don't drink much, huh? You know, and you just one glass of wine is getting you tipsy like this, you know? But I didn't, you know, and I used to lie about my drinking, and I used to try to hide it, but I didn't know that I had a problem. You know, it's crazy. No, but it just became really shameful after a while. Near the end of my drinking, I became like a Bible-toting maniac. I didn't know the Bible well, but I used to carry a Bible around with me, and I would get one verse out of that Bible, and I would run with it. And I would tell my friends, and after I got drunk, you know, I would start, you know, like preaching to them and, you know, telling them that, you know, they're going to go to the devil if they keep up this drinking, and, you know, and it's not good. And, you know, I would keep reading this verse after, you know, this verse over and over and over again. And they said, well, you're drinking, you know, where do you think you're going to go? You know, I said, yeah, but I got the Bible, you know, in my hand, and, you know, you, oh my goodness. I was mad. And I remember one of my girlfriends threw me out of the house. Her husband had brought company over, and I had my Bible and I had my verse, and I started preaching to the company. And, you know, my girlfriend, who was the sweetest person ever, she took me in a room and she said, Diane, you know, this is not the time nor the place. You know, take your Bible and get out of here. And the next thing, you're throwing me out? You know, me? And yes, you have to leave. And this guy, I was on the outside of her door, you know, looking at, you know, her door, like, how could she do this to me? You know, so I went home, and I got more drunk, and I started calling everyone, you know, saying she threw me out the house. And they're like, but she's so sweet. You know, she wouldn't kill a fly. What happened to her? I said, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't dare say, you know, give my part of the story. You know, and it's just in jobs. You know, I did finally go back and learn a trade, and I was a I became a graphic designer. Really, really good job. You know, I really loved it. But I messed up on this job constantly. You know, constantly coming in, taking off Fridays, Mondays, and just, you know, going in the bathroom. You know, with hangovers and thinking, okay, I'm just going to sit on the stool for like 5 minutes, get my head together, you know, then I'll go back. And I would be in there for like 4 hours, you know, and I'd go back and be like, where were you? You know, we had this job to get out and we were looking all over for you. And it's like, oh, my God. I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. And then I landed one job that actually had a nurse's quarters downstairs. Now, I didn't know that they had a bed, and they had beds down there. So one day, because I just had migraine headaches when I did come in on Mondays, you know, I had migraine headaches. So they would send me, so one person asked me, would you like to go downstairs to the nurse's quarters and get something for your headache? I said, yeah. So when I went down there, the nurse asked me, would you like to lie down? I said, lie down? And she said, yeah, we have beds in the back. And I said, sure. So I, you know, went and lied down. So a few days out of the week, I had migraine headaches, you know, so I can go down to this bed and lie down. And I used to go down here, and I used to be down in this bed for the whole day. I would get down, maybe get to work 9 o'clock, and I told my supervisor, I got a migraine headache, you know, and they would just look at me like, here she goes again, you know, and I would go downstairs, and the nurses were even like, oh, here she goes again, you know. So it got to the point where they just started saying, just go in the back, you know, go in the back. And I would ask them for blankets and pillow. You know, people would actually come down here who were actually not feeling well, and they'll get an aspirin, and they'll stay maybe 15 minutes, and they'll go back to work. I was down here the full day, you know, and I was asking for blankets, pillows, and just sleeping off my hangover. Well, I just got, you know, I got really tired of this life, you know, the hangovers, the putting myself in dangerous situations, you know, like making promises I never kept, and even promises to myself, you know, things that I wanted to do and achieve in life. And I just never did it because alcohol always interfered. And I remember the meetings that my brother was taking me to. And I remember reading that first step, and I thought how ridiculous it was. Until one night I was in a situation where I really saw where I was powerless over alcohol. You know, and I had those, what Bill W. describes as periods of sobriety. I had those intervals where I would stop drinking for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and I thought I had it, you know, that I'm cured now, you know. But then I'd go right back to drinking. And I used to actually, and I love another thing what Bill describes about when he states he laughed at the gin mills when he had those periods of sobriety. And I did this, you know. I identify with this book, you know, as we all do. And I used to laugh at people who were in the liquor stores when I had those periods of sobriety. Like, they just don't know. They don't get it, you know. All you have to do is drink ginger ale, and you'll be fine. Because to me, that was like my cure in those 3 weeks when I wasn't drinking. But after a while, alcohol found its way into that ginger ale. No, and I just got on my knees one day, and I said, you know, God, I need your help. I cannot do this alone. I'd never asked for God's help before. I have faith in God. I mean, I believed in God, but I never had faith in God. Because whenever any challenges or problems arose, I went straight to the bottle. You know, I would ask God to perform these little genie tricks for me, which he never did. And I like, for instance, if it's today's Tuesday, I was, okay, God, Wednesday, I want you to do this at 2 o'clock. And, you know, Wednesday, 2 o'clock came, and he didn't perform this trick for me, I would become angry, you know. So when I came into this program, I really believe I came in on the first, second, and third step. Now, when I went to God on my knees that day, I realized I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had become unmanageable. I came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And the third thing is that I, at that moment, I turned my life over to the care of God. I worked these steps formally when I came into the program, but you know, just looking back, I know that those three steps that I was definitely using that day. I came into this program. I went to the first meeting, as I stated earlier, for myself. And there was a person who was sharing. My brother told me to meet him at this meeting. He said it starts at 5 o'clock, and for me to get there in the front and hold a seat for him. And I did all of these things he asked me to do. My brother never showed up at the meeting, but I held that seat, and I wouldn't let anyone sit in it. I would, like, scream at them if they tried to. They knew I was a newcomer, and they just left me alone. So, And I heard, you know, the person who was speaking, he said, there is a solution. And that image of a light bulb, I actually felt it went off on top of my head. And I sat back in my seat and I exhaled, it seems like for the first time in my life. And I said, oh, my God, there is a solution to this madness. And I had never equated my life with madness before. And I said, oh. You know, when the meeting was over, I tried to grab every single person in that meeting and was asking them, what is the solution? Give me the solution, please. I need that solution. I was desperate as the dying can be. And they kept telling me, just keep coming, you'll get it. You know, and I kept coming. My sobriety date is September 2nd, 1989, and it's a beautiful journey. Oh. Thank you. It's awesome. I love it. And I work these steps. I love these steps. I love these principles. I was able to make amends to both my parents before they passed away. And I specify before they passed away because we really have some creative ways of making amends to people who have passed on. I have since gone back to school. I used to sit across, because I dropped out of school in eighth grade. Well, I always say eighth. I did go to school one day in the ninth grade, you know, and I said, that's it, no more. You know, I'm totally convinced I don't need this business, the school business. And, you know, I have since gone back to school in AA. You know, I came in without a high school diploma in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've, you know, achieved a wonderful education here. I used to go down to NYU, and I used to hang out there, and I used to drink, and I used to look at NYU school, and I used to say, well, I would love to go to that school. It's so cute and quaint, and I love movies, and I said, this used to be old mansions, you know, like in the like turn of the century, and I, you know, knew the history of the area, and then I would hear that voice, you know, you're not going to get in that school, you dummy. You know, you don't even have a high school education, and I said, yeah, that's true. You know, then I would drink. I graduated from that school. I got a full scholarship from one of my jobs to go to get a master's degree there. And other jobs that I had, they would just look at me like, is she still here? You know, they hated me. And now this job loved me. I'm in sobriety now. You know, they give you a full scholarship. I've done things in AA, lots of achievements that I've always wanted to do when I was drinking, but as I stated earlier, alcohol always interfered. You know, I had a little TV show. I love movies, so I wanted to be a critic, so I said, well, let's just do it. Because that voice now tells me, you can do it. You can do it. That voice gets louder and louder now. And that other voice that's, you can't do it, dummy, that's very, 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 very small, you know. And I said, oh, shut up, you know. And I listen to this, you know, this beautiful, nurturing, encouraging voice now, like the hope that someone was talking about earlier. I became aerobic and an instructor part-time. I took all kinds of salsa and ballroom dance, and I've always wanted to do that. You know, I've done that. I learned how to ride a bike at 45 years old because I was too busy out bumming in the street for money to drink. I never learned how to ride a bike. I took swimming lessons, riding. You know, it's just like I feel like the world is like my big playground now. I can do whatever I want to do, you know, but the biggest, and those are great achievements, they're fun, I love them, but the best achievement is my relationship with God today. You know, I love God. Oh my God, I love him. I pray to him every single morning and at night, and I also pray for him to keep me sober in the morning. At night, I thank him right before getting in my bed. I pray and I thank him for keeping me sober. I work these steps. I help others. I love helping others. I remember when one of my sponsor passed away, and some fifth step stuff started coming up again, you know, because I've done a few fourth and fifth steps in this program. And I was like, well, who am I going to talk to now? You know, my sponsor has passed away, and I know the benefits of doing a fifth step, that great feeling it gives you to clean house. And I remember hearing someone say, it's easy to keep a clean house clean. And so I want to keep this house clean, you know, because I used to hold on to stuff in that self-constructed prison that I was living in. I want to be free today, and I don't want to hold on to anything. I want it all out. And I was sitting in an emergency room once. I hurt my wrist, and a priest walked by, and I asked him, something told me, because I pray and I meditate, and so when I hear that inner voice say, go ahead, ask him. You know, and I got up and I asked him, I said, are you familiar with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, my name is Diane. And he said, yes, I am. And I said, well, I have a fifth step that I would like to, you know, go over with you if you don't mind. And he said, as soon as you finish here, he gave me his room number. And when I finished in the emergency room, I went to him and we were in there for 3 hours. You know, that's how important it is for me to work this program. I make amends to people. Genuine amends. You know, my sponsor taught me. She said, when you make amends, it's not about asking a person to forgive you. She said, because they don't have to forgive you. They may not want to forgive you. She said, it's just about you cleaning your side of the street. And because I see people asking people, like, I'm sorry, do you forgive me? Please forgive me. And she also explains to me, that's emotional blackmail. You know, they may not want to forgive you. My 10th step, you know, constantly take an inventory. And I love to pray and meditate. You know, when I had a year in this program, and I like to share this for people who may be new or may be struggling. As much fun as I was having in this program, the friends that I had and the good times, the desire to drink came back, and it came back strong. And I remember crying to my sponsor, oh, I want to drink. I need to drink. You know, it's back. And I used to smell it. I smell it in the air. I smell cognac. I smell gin over here. You know, I smell vodka. I smelled it. And she told me, Diane, this too shall pass. She said, ask God to help you get over this, just like he did the first time. You know, because I didn't know about before when I was drinking, you know, mental obsession, physical compulsion. And that desire, oh my God, it was so strong. So it took me over, I would say, almost close to 2 months. And then it finally disappeared. It went away. And I didn't drink. And I didn't have to drink. You know, that was just a feeling. It came back again 3 years later. And this time it didn't last as long and it wasn't as intense because now I had a sober reference, you know, so. This is a wonderful program. I love what it's doing for my life. I love what God the woman that God is making me, you know, the woman that I'm becoming, the woman I've always wanted to become, but just didn't know how to, didn't know how to get there. And it's through God and through these wonderful steps that I'm living a happy, joyous, free life. I'm living a wonderful life now. And, you know, there's some things that I still want to do, and I feel held back a little, but I have hope. I know that I will do them. Thank you all. Thank you.